Thank you for coming. Okay, so I want to do three things this year. First of all, the title is Do Angels Fast at Yom Kippur? And as my daughter immediately noticed, my 10-year-old daughter, that the question makes no sense unless you assume that angels eat the rest of the year. So on the first level, this shir is just a straightforward text shir about whether or not angels eat. But there are two other levels that I which I want to give the shir, which are related to being in memory of Dr. Hammer. The first is I want to use that topic as a basis for at least occasionally discussing questions about how one deals with contemporary issues of text criticism in the context of Talmud study, and in general about what the Talmud is, very, very briefly. And secondly, the main focus is how we deal with texts that are part of the Masoret, that we even may see as binding parts of the Masoret, that seem to have frameworks and assumptions that are different from ours and may even be highly alienating to us, like saying, wow, I don't really want to share that framework of assumption. So how do we deal with those texts and maintain our relationship with them as authoritative while being honest about the extent to which those frameworks, which their frameworks are different than ours? Those are both topics that my impression is were dear to Dr. Hammer's heart. So hopefully this is a fitting memorial. Okay, so we'll start off with the text. This is source number one, from Avot de Rabbi Natan. Avot de Rabbi Natan is a text about which we know very little. You can say it is either an expansion of or the thing from which Masechet Avot was abstracted. Right, so we know that, that it seems to have some kind of relationship to what we call Masechet Avot in Shishat Sidrei Mishnah. We don't know what that relationship is, and as we'll see, Avot de Rabbi Natan is generally described as falling into two different manuscript traditions, which are called Nusach A and Nusach B. This is the categorization that was set out by Solomon Schechter in the expanded edition of them. I know very little about this. I just know that there's a version A and a version B, and you can decide, you can do your own research as to what the tradition is. So here's what Avot de Rabbi Natan version B, chapter 43, says. There are shivat zayin dvarim. There are seven things, ulim zem yizeh, which are hierarchically arranged. This one above this. Now we'll discover there are actually eight, which is going to be a bit of a problem. All right. So number zero, I guess, is the aretz, which we will tentatively translate as the land. And lamala min aretz is the rakia, and above the land is the rakia, which, and so far we're perfectly happy. Above the rakia, the land, above the land is the sky. And above the sky are the stars. Now that, again, is not a terribly difficult notion for us to assimilate from an intellectual history point of view. The only thing he says is, because the stars move, whereas the sky is fixed. Now that is that's a challenging notion to fit. It depends on what your astronomical scheme is. In which we view the stars as moving in on a fixed plane. The Yesh Omrim, but there are those who say, Afu Choser Kegalgal Lamala, that some people say that even that the Rakia is also turning as a wheel, and nonetheless the stars move, and that requires all sorts of complicated astronomical gyrations. Okay, so far we're fine. We got the land, we got the sky, we got the stars. Lamala mina kochavim ma'ilanot, but above the stars are the trees. This is where I get lost. What trees are there above the stars? Except that Elinot ofin perot, that trees give fruit and stars do not give fruit. Now, either we have left the realm of physicality entirely, right? And so what we say by trees is something that is represented by, that can be metaphorically described as trees, or else the whole, right, the whole notion that we were describing things physically is gone, and we're describing things in terms of some kind of other philosophic hierarchy. I don't get it. I can tell you that. Above the trees are the ruchot, which the ruchot are some kind of spirit, and I can't really tell you what kind of spirits they are, but their spirits are things that function like winds, because they blow and come, whereas trees stand still. Lemala min ruchot behema. And above the spirits are the behemot, who eat and drink, whereas the winds do not eat and drink, or the spirits do not eat and drink. So far, again, I'm totally lost. I have no idea what any of this means, and I won't pretend to. Above the behemot is bnei adam, human beings, because bnei adam have a dot, but that we have two additions here. One which says, but not Masa. One of them says, but Masa. Since I don't know what Masa is, I have no conception of knowing of whether the correct text is yes or no. And we get to our key line. L'malav ne'adam, but above ne'adam, who may or may not be human beings, are the malachei hasharet, right, which are usually translated as the ministering angels, which is a good translation, actually. Ela ch'ne'adam l'chlim v'shotim v'farim v'ravim v'shenim l'metim, except that human beings eat, drink, are fruitful and multiply, sleep and die, l'malachei hasharet, enam l'chlim v'shotim v'farim v'ravim v'shenim l'metim. But the ministering angels do not eat or drink, are not fruitful and multiply, and do not sleep and do not die. Okay, that seems pretty straightforward, that angels don't eat or drink. And therefore, the question of whether angels fast Yom Kippur is moot, because Yom Kippur is no different than any other day of the year, unless you wanted to construct a tradition in which angels eat only on Yom Kippur, in order to be the exact opposite of human beings. Fine. Now, this position that angels don't eat on Yom Kippur has a fun halachic nafkamina, which I give you from the Sefer Kolbo, which is a medieval halachic anthology, in which Rabbi Yonatan of Kanuka, I don't know if that's Kanyak or I don't know, asked Rabbi Meir Halevi, who I presume is Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, and he has an interesting question. He's a full-time Talmud scholar, and full-time Talmud scholars are exempt from all taxation, except that the community has pointed out that while he is a full-time Talmud scholar in the sense that he never leaves his house to go to the market, he does run a money lending business outside of his house. And so the community is making the claim that they ought to be able to tax him because, after all, he's running a business out of his house. And he appeals to tell these people that, no, I'm a full-time Talmud scholar. I just happen to run a business out of my house. I never leave my house. So how can you not say Torah Tum Nafi, that my Torah is my profession? Now, Rabbi Rothenberg, in response to this, says, right, this is where it says Tshuva, Hachin Chazina, this is how I see it, these people who object to somebody who is in fact a Torah scholar by profession and only abandons study of Torah a little bit every day so as to support himself, and they want to make him pay taxes, let they meshasha. Right? This complaint that he is not a full-time Torah scholar because he lends money out of his house of interest has no basis. Why? Because of what? Do we want all Torah scholars to be beggars? Right? Exemption from taxation doesn't get you food. So if you're going to make the claim that any Torah scholar who has any source of income is automatically loses their tax exemption, then that's telling you the only Torah scholars the tax exemption applies to are beggars. And what he says is, or this is the end, he says, are you going to claim that the tax exemption kiman is maru? It has to be either obe machazir na lapsachim is maru, it's either said about beggars who go door to door, obe malachei hasharet, or about angels, sheinano queen v'shotin, who do not eat and drink, who trichin l'chol tzorchei haguf, or have any bodily needs. From which we deduce that angels have no bodily needs. Okay, this is a fun halakhic consequence, right? Since human beings are unlike angels, human beings do have bodily needs, so Torah scholars can engage in a profession so long as they do so minimally, with minimal cost to the Torah scholarship, and still be considered Torah Talmud Natav. Okay, so angels don't eat and drink. I would bet that probably most of you came in assuming that rabbinic tradition thinks that angels don't eat and drink. That's probably the reasonable assumption. And now look, we're all confirmed. Avot Rabbi Natan says it. Right? It's so obvious that the Marami Rottenberg can even use it as a trope, you know, like, what do you think? Torah scholars are like angels, don't even drink. But, in the interest of intellectual honesty, we have to point out that there is also a Masechet Avot Rabbi Natan Nuscha Aleph. This is source number 3, which, now, this one does not have 8, right? The last one started with Aretz. The Aretz happily gets left out, and it says, really, right, it really has everything reversed, also. Because the first thing it says, source number 3, is, Lamala mikulam bara rakia. Above everything was created the rakia. But then there are things above the rakia, so what everything includes is not clear. But whereas in the first Avodah Zarah time, we started with Aretz, and so there were 8 terms, Aretz just somehow didn't count. It really means there are 7, you have to interpret that text as saying there are 7 things above the Aretz, hierarchically arranged. So here we have the same 7 things. And we get down to the bottom, it says, Lamala min Adam bara malachei hasharet. So above the Adam, he created these ministering angels. Shemalachei Hasharet Holchin Misof Olam Ve'ad Sofo, because the ministering angels go from one end of the world to the other end, whatever that may mean. Uvnei Adam Ve'no Kein, and people are not like that. So I don't know what that means either, but what I know is that Avot Rabbi Natan did not, the version Aleph does not mention that the difference between human beings and angels is that human beings eat and angels do not. Now, then we get into a question of what the relationship between the two versions of Avot Rabbi Natan is. If we assume that version Aleph was written with version Bet in front of it and was reacting to it, so then we have a tradition which took out the notion that that human beings eat and angels do not eat. Presumably that was not because it didn't believe that human beings don't eat, but rather because it believed that angels did. But since we don't know the relationship between the versions, it could simply be that there are two utterly independent traditions about whether what in this context the distinction between human beings and angels is, and we certainly have no evidence whatsoever for any Jewish position that angels do eat. Okay, source number four. So Tehillim chapter 78 is a somewhat disorderly retelling of Jewish history. At one point, it gets, among others, it gets to the story of the desert, and it describes it as follows. Right? So God, Vayitzav shechakim mima'al, he commanded the clouds above, v'dalte shamayim patach, and he opened the doors of heaven. Vayamter alehem man le'echol, and he rained upon them manna to eat. Udgan shamayim natan lama, and he gave them the grains of heaven. Lechem abirim achal ish, teda shalach lehem lasova. So an ish ate lechem abirim, and in addition, he sent them provisions sufficient to save them. So what does lechem abirim achal ish? Who are the abirim? Presumably the abirim are not the ish. Right, so something, right, and abir is usually translated as some kind of term of strength. Right, so presumably we are saying there that an ish ate, right, and since this is talking about the grandeur of the man, it's saying that, right, that the man is some kind of lechem which is not your standard kind of lechem, it's the lechem of abirim, and an ish ate it. So who are the abirim? So Ibn Ezra says, lechem abirim heim hashchakim. The abirim are the clouds. Now, I have an ongoing polemic against the notion that...
Is it saying that abirim are clouds, or lechem abirim, like the bread is the clouds?
No. I think it's lechem abirim. I think it's that the lechem of the clouds. That's what it means. The shchakim are the abirim. Maybe they were very powerful clouds because if you're holding bread in it as a suspension as opposed to water, you have to have a somewhat stronger structure presumably. I don't know. Some of you may know an ongoing polemic against the notion that pshat is somehow more related to a text, or that the interpretation conventionally known as pshat, right, should be presumed to be a closer reading of text than midrash. And here you have a very standard influence. Does Ibn Ezra have any other use of the word abir that means cloud? No. He made it up. Why did he make it up? Because he couldn't think of anything else. Right, why could... right, now, why couldn't he think of anything else? Because he knew what the other possibility was, but he didn't like it. Right, so pshat is that lechem abirim means the bread of the clouds. And you can also face, if you look at modern translations, you'll see that some of them will say bread of the clouds or things like that. And this is purely a function of philosophic bias. Because who else could there be, right? What else could mana be?
Are you saying that Ibn Ezra didn't believe in angels, so he couldn't say that abirim were angels?
Well, I think he believed in angels. Just not clear to me he believed that angels ate. Right, now, the interesting thing about this is that Ibn Ezra is, of course, I presume, aware of the Gemara Yuma Daf Ayin Hey Amud Bet, which is what we're really interested in, which is source number six. Right, so Gemara Yuma Daf Ayin Hey Amud Bet says, Lechem Abirim Achal Ish, Lechem Shemalachei Hashareit Ochlin Oso, Divrei Rabbi Akiva. Right, who are the Abirim? The Abirim are the ministering angels. Okay. Uchishinevru Devar Lefnei Rabbi Yishmael, but when Rabbi Yishmael came along, right, heard these words of Rabbi Akiva, he said, Akiva ta'ita. Akiva, you made a mistake. Do you think that the ministering angels eat bread? But look, lechem lo chalti mayim lo shasisi. But it already says, right? It already says, I did not eat bread, I did not drink water. Now, who says that and when?
Moshe about his communion with God at Sinai.
Moshe about his communion with God at Sinai. So we know that, what do we know? What does that prove?
It's possible to live without bread or water.
It's possible to live without bread or water. Good.
Like if you're on a certain spiritual level.
Uh-huh. So you know that if you're on a certain spiritual level, you can live without bread or water. And therefore, so Moshe was like an angel. And
right.
So they prove the fact that Moshe didn't eat bread, therefore angels must not eat bread either.
Must not have to
eat bread. Okay. And so therefore, the machloket between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva is, Rabbi Akiva thinks angels eat, and Rabbi Shmuel doesn't. And the two versions of Zot Rabbeinatan are reflect, respectively, a Rabbi Akiva tradition and a Rabbi Shmuel tradition. Abraham Joshua Heschel will be very happy right now. Right, and we can all say, good, so now we have a fundamental tradition. Now, usually when this is presented, right, there's the Rabbi Akiva tradition and the Rabbi Shmuel tradition, so we think, of course, that Rabbi Shmuel is the one who says, Dibrat Torah Kelashon Bnei Adam, the Torah speaks in human language, so he must be Pshat. Right? Good. What does Rabbi Shmuel say? Ella. Mani Mekayim Avirim. What does Avirim mean? It means Lechem Shenivlav Matayim V'Arba'im L'Shmana Avirim. It means bread that is absorbed into all 248 organs of your body. So the Pshat, right, the non-mystical interpretation, is the one which says we will read the word Avirim as if it said Avarim, and then we will translate the phrase Lechem Avarim to mean bread that is magically absorbed into all 248 organs of your body. That's Pshat, as opposed to Rabbi Akiva, who is this crazy mystic, not reading the text, who thinks that Lechem Avirim means bread, right, means bread eaten by the finger angels. No, no, no. Avarim, not bones.
No, but don't we generally say?
Limbs, if you want. Kind of, 248 is a peculiar number. Now, you might ask, who cares that it's absorbed in the 248 organs? Do we care how many organs it's absorbed into? No, that's right. Elamani mitayim b'yateit yelecha alevinecha. Okay, v'yateit yelecha alevinecha, as the Pasuk in Varemish teaches us, that the Jews in the desert had an obligation to dig latrines. Now, if, for the point, so Rabbi Shmuel, again, this is pshat, right? We're avoiding the mystical stuff. Right, Rabbi Shmuel said is that the mana was absorbed into the 248 organs so that there was no need to excrete. And the problem with his interpretation, right, this is not a problem for Rabbi Akiva, right? Because just because of Rabbi Akiva, just because of angelic bread doesn't seem to mean that there's any reason that angelic bread in a human metabolism doesn't have the same result as ordinary bread. Rabbi Ishmael, who now is compelled to believe to read Lechem Avirim as Lechem Avarim, now has to explain how there can be a command to dig latrines. And his answer is, that the Jews, being dissatisfied with the man, as we know repeatedly, would buy dessert from non-Jewish, right, from Gentile merchants. And so their need to go to the bathroom was occasioned entirely by their external purchases.
All the non-Jews floating around in the side.
The non-Jews floating around, and we know, right, the Jews went out regularly, that's how Amalek attacked them, right, because they would stand outside the clouds and say, look, we've got this stuff for sale, and the Jews would leave the clouds to buy the stuff, and that's when they would attack them. Okay, so the Rabbi Elazar ben Parta over the come along and says, no, Aftvarim Chetagre Moto Lamachrin Lahem Man Mafigan. That the man not only was it absorbed, but it served as sort of an all-purpose digestive solvent. So that even if you ate other stuff, right, as long as you were eating man, you still didn't have to go to the bathroom. Elamani mekayim v'tayet dechal avin. Efel after shesarku. Right, this is talking about after the Jews sinned, presumably at the Egel of the Hav. Right, so they lost their capacity to digest man perfectly. And then there's sort of this semi-comic interlude in which God says, Ani amarti yu kemalachei hasharei. I said they would be like the angels, which would mean what? Not that they don't eat.
They don't excrete.
I would be like angels in that they eat and they don't excrete. Right? But once the Jews ate the egel hazahav, right, then God said, I'm going to make them walk three parsaot, whatever that may be, about a mile or whatever, several miles back, because the command to take the telechal adinetha means you have to go back where the camp came from. You don't want to dig latrines in front of you on your path. Right, so all the trees have to be behind you. So that means that somebody at the front of the camp would now, right, whereas before he would be like an angel, now he has to walk several miles to go to the bathroom. Okay, and then we have another drasha on the phrase Vatanet Sheni Shvesha in Kol, in which Amru, we don't know who this Amru is, said this man will eventually explode in their intestines. Right, Kum Yesh Ludi Shasha Nachnis Beinem Motzi. Right, somebody figured out that the man's got to be going somewhere. Right, so what's going to happen to them? So right. Rabbi Shmuel said, no, don't worry. Rabbi Shmuel's response here is not to Rabbi Akiva. He says, don't worry about it. Okay? So Rishmal, in this version, is not opposing Rabbi Akiva's reading that it refers to the angels. He is opposing people's skepticism about the claim that there could be such a thing as the human as food that the human, the human being metabolizes perfectly. Okay? And he says that therefore, right, so how did you support the obligation for latrine? That they bought things from overseas, which is the same thing. Okay, now the reason that I was always interested by this Gemara, which seemed sort of a little bit too ribald to be religiously inspiring, and when I learned the eighth parak of Masechet Yoma, which disappeared, I always bothered, like, what are we doing talking about whether angels eat or not? All right, why does it matter? And particularly, why are we talking about the whole question of whether the monk sent us to the bathroom or not? So when I was having a discussion with the Maimonides Talmud faculty some years ago about teaching this parak, so it suddenly occurred to me that I had a really fun interpretation of how the Agadah and the Halakha connected, which is important for the whole question of how Agadah and Halakha relate in the Talmud. Right? Because usually when we teach you Talmud, we teach you, well, here in the halachic sections, there might be a separate Agadah shir, right? But which never addresses the question of why it is that the Talmud is organized in this particular fashion with Halakha and Agadah intermingled. And I was also used to be very bothered by the question of why is the Talmud written in this really peculiar fashion until I realized that, oh, they got it from Torah. And so if one can figure out, if one can understand why the Torah chooses to intermingle narrative and halakha, then one might also be able to figure out why the Talmud does. And presumably the reason the Torah intermingles narrative and halakha is because narrative and halakha are supposed to connect to each other. So maybe the Talmud also, the narrative and the halakha are supposed to connect to each other. So it occurred to me, the eighth parak of Yoma is about fasting. So now, let's suppose there's a machloket about whether angels eat or not. Now, what's the machloket about whether angels eat or not? The machloket is about whether if you have a body, you can be an angel or not. Because, and there's a fundamental chakira about the nature of fasting. Is fasting designed to enable you to overcome the body? Right? In other words, that you, what you really are trying to be is, right, let's just presume that on Yom Kippur we're all trying to be angels. So how does one become an angel? Does one become an angel by denying the body? And so we fast to weaken the body so that your soul can have more control. Or do you become an angel by purifying the body? Okay, and we fast on Yom Kippur, to show, right, that our bodies should be able to function like angels. Now, an interesting thing would be, so the fundamental of the machlokas in this scheme would be about whether bodies are perfectible. The claim that angels eat is a claim that bodies are perfectible. The claim that angels don't eat is a claim that bodies are hopeless. And the reason we don't eat on Yom Kippur is because we are unable to eat in the way that angels eat, because when we eat, we end up having to excrete. But in principle, nobody should think that the purpose of fasting is to overcome the body rather than to purify it. I thought this was a really neat explanation of why this particular Agadah is right in the middle of the discussion about eating and about fasting on Yom Kippur. And then if you take a look at the halachic sections, you discover the halachic sections are tend up being discussions about precisely the same question. Really interesting, right? Gemara wants to know why we fail to eat and drink as opposed to beating ourselves up. Right? If the goal of Torah says you need to beneath them, afflict yourself, so why do we settle for just not eating? Let's take really sharp, barbed wire things and whip each other across the back. Right? Or let's make sure that we sit in really hot places, with mirrors all around us so we can sizzle. The Gemara says, no, we don't do that. Right, we don't seek to mortify the flesh. We fast. Now maybe that's because, right, if we were trying to overcome the body, there are more effective ways of overcoming the body than fasting. But fasting is a way of limiting the distractions of the body. Okay, this is what I used to think.
I don't understand the distinction you're making between purifying the body and
overcoming really means being alive is a pain, right? We are souls, right? We are souls, and we're stuck in a body, So the goal is to have that body, right, be around as, you know, be as weak as possible. The other possibility is no, we are is a combination of souls and bodies, but our body is not the kind of body it should be. Our body has desires, right, that it's not supposed to have. Our body is an imperfect machine which takes things that God put in this world and can't assimilate them. Right? But really, right, the goal is to make it to create a better body. I just point out, you know, interesting notion just philosophically is that you should be aware that while instinctively, if one were to ask most of you in Jewish tradition, right, when you say I, right, do you mean I am the soul in the body? Or is I the body which happens to be inhabited by a soul? Most of you would say I is the neshama, right? Right? But you wake up in the morning and you say, Modi al yuvanecha melechai v'keyam shechazarta bi, nishmati. Elokai neshama shenatata bi. To Harahi, right?
Yeah,
right.
You're either a body or a soul, as opposed to, I think, more than because you're both. That's a nice...
When
you're asleep, you're kind of dead, because you're not...
Both. Yeah, I don't know. Or maybe you're neshama, maybe you're in Gan Eden, and then you're forced to return to these batei chomer. Right? Those are the reasonable perspectives. Right? I just pointing out that you shouldn't assume one of them as opposed to the other. Right? At least if you pay attention to the liturgy, you are at least as often a body as a soul. Okay. So this is what I thought. I thought it was a really good reading of the Perek. So here we get to the intellectual honesty part of it, because I'm not at all sure that this is at all true. Right. So let's take a look at the Sfat Emet, the Ger Rebbe. This is source number 7. So Sfat Emet says, source number 7, commentary on Shas, right? We quote commenting Rabbi Kiva, who says, "Do angels really eat bread?" But it says, "I didn't eat bread." So the Shalem says, "L'chora kasha, the hader adaraba, luchok lehitzuk." It's the opposite. "Midahutzruch lomar lechem lochalti." Since Moshe had to say, "I didn't eat bread," like dull, you're in heaven. Who would think you eat bread, right? "Mas v'shayach l'mala shiuch alechem," right? So the obvious implication is that you can't eat bread above, and Moshe's telling you, "But I didn't eat bread." Well, you know, I was sitting at the angelic feast, and they were all eating, but I didn't eat bread or drink water for 40 days. So what kind of proof is this Rabbi Shmuel is bringing? So the Shalem says, "Venerely, the cave in the chtiv lechem lo achalti, mashman adavar acher achal. Yidomar stam lo achalti." So Emmet, who's a wonderfully hypersensitive reader, says, why did Moshe have to say he didn't eat bread? Right? He should have said he didn't eat. So obviously he ate something other than bread. Right? So this, right? So then he says, Vesu, and it's a very interesting point. He says, Vesu, di esher leveri aliyos b'lim mazon. Angels are created beings. Right, created beings have contingent as opposed to necessary existence. The universe is naturally entropic. Right, so in the absence of a source of energy, everything falls apart. So if angels continue, they must have some source of energy. Yeah, right. So now we have I have a textual proof that angels must eat, and secondly, I have a rational proof that angels must eat. So that leads us to the question: where did Rabbi Shmuel get this idea from?
Yeah, but the source of energy has to be food.
Yeah, that's what food is, the source of energy.
The only source of energy?
Ah, so now we'll get to the whole question of semantics, right? No, right, well, bread is not, certainly, you know, certainly angels do not live by bread alone. Right, so mizeh, right, mizeh hukhiyach Rabbi Yishmael, the malachi asharet enon nizonon milechem. Right, so Rabbi Yishmael proves from here that the source of sustenance, the mazon of angels, is not bread. This is what Moshe is really saying. Lechem sh'ochon ha'tachtonim lo'akalti. I didn't eat the kind of bread that you guys below eat. Rak macha olyonim. I ate the food, I ate nectar and ambrosia. Im kein, mukach demachal malachim enoman. So that tells us that since the man, since the human beings below, all the Jews were eating man, and Moshe says, I wasn't eating the same stuff you guys were, so that proves that lechem abirim, which, right, isn't man anymore. Because man is what everybody else is eating, and Moshe is the only one who didn't eat. Moshe is the only one who didn't eat this lechem. Okay, so now let's watch what the Sfat Emet claims is going on here. First of all, lechem abirim akal ish doesn't mean that everybody ate lechem abirim. Right, now we're paying attention to the close singular, right? Right, what's very careful, right? It says, right, everywhere in the verse it says, vayamper alehem man, uvidigam shemayim natan lamo, plural. Lechem avirim achal ish, singular. Seidash alach lahem, plural. So lechem avirim is the thing which is given to one person, whereas the man is given to everybody else. Okay.
We said it was bred from the clouds. We kind of assumed that falls down, but there wasn't necessarily, like, in the Ibn Ezra, he didn't say that.
That's true, but it says, but Ibn Ezra just says the first thing, which says Vaytav Shlokim Imal, Lechem Ibrim is just parallel to Vaytav Shlokim Imal.
Okay, so he's saying, no,
it's
just like man, normal.
Right, so Ibn Ezra claims that this is man, so then it says, A, you're ignoring the fact that Achal Ish is singular. B, Rabbi Shmuel's proof is backwards. C, who would possibly think that angels don't need to eat? And therefore, the Fatemis concludes that, in fact, angels do eat, just what they eat is not man. And Rabbi Shmuel's whole disagreement with Rabbi Akiva is not that he has a disagreement with Rabbi Akiva's notion that angels eat. He agrees that angels eat. The disagreement is that Rabbi Akiva thinks that angels eat man. And Rabbi Shmuel thinks they eat something else. Okay, so now that raises, you know, that sort of messes up my drush. Because now everyone agrees that angels eat. Right? So there's no longer a machloket. Now it messes up the whole Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel dispute about between the two versions of Rav and Rabbi Natan, because there is no position that angels don't eat.
Well, everyone agrees that angels need a source of energy.
Yeah. Lechem Avirim, right? Which can be called Lechem. So what you do with Lechem is you eat it, no? Right, and Achal Ish, right? So, right, what Moshe did was he Ochel Lechem in the way the Avirim do. But you resist this, right? Because angels can't eat, because you have a free grade, because you're a priori committed to that notion that angels can't eat. Oh, yeah. So am I. Right, that's why it's a problematic text. Okay, so now my drush is unfortunately problematic, but who says that Sfat-Emes is right? All right, as well as Sfat-Emes itself is a drushy reader. Right, and like all drush readers, he pays close attention to text, so he notices things like singulars and plurals, which Pshatniks generally disregard and say, oh, you know, that's just a piece of poetic, a poetic sleight of hand. Right, so we can claim that...
Or that it happens all the time and enough that...
And each time, are interchanged, and that is meaningless, right? Because if you're a Pshatnik, you understand that, right, word choice is not really so important.
Right,
grammatical, right, person is not so important. All those sorts of things are just things that mistakes that writers make to change or confuse us to change things up, as opposed to a drushnik, right, where you have this crazy notion that language matters.
Yeah, if you put it that way.
Yeah, I like to put it that way. I'm obviously I'm being polemical, but this is a polemic of mine, but it is the case that he notices that it's a chalish, and it's an interesting notion. Sometimes, it is really very clear that it matters. If someone has a Tanakh, so let me read you a little poem from Bereshit and from Bereshit Parashah, I believe it is. Zeh Sefer Tzoldan. Poems rhyme. I'm old fashioned that way. Sometimes poems rhyme. Watch this. Zeh Sefer Tzoldot Adam, V'yom Bro Elokim Adam, V'dmut Elokim Asa Otam, Zachar Nekeva Biraam, V'yvarech Otam. Vayikra et Shemam Adam, Vayom Hibaram. Wasn't that neat?
Except one of them is Otam.
Yes, except if you actually read from us, what it says is, Zeh Sefer Toldot al Yadam, Vayom Bro Elokim Adam, Vidmut Elokim Asa, Oto. Zachar Nekeva, Braam, Vayvarech Otam, Vayikra et Shemam Adam, Vayom Hibaram. Now that's, you know, you could say, oh, it's just occasionally a shift, you know, it just shifts into singular in that one place. Except it's really peculiar to shift into singular in the one, right, in a way which totally messes up a rhyme scheme, which it goes out of its way the next verse to tell you, right, Bra'am, Otam, Shemam, Adam, Hibaram. We have to use the word Hibaram, right, in order to make this work, right, but we couldn't say Otam. No. Now, when we recall, in Perek Aleph of Bereshit, it also happens to say, Vayivra Elokim et Adam b'tzalmo, b'tzalam Elokim bara oto, zachar nekeva bara otam. So now we have a pattern in which in the creation of human beings we regularly shift between singular and plural in this one problematic notion, right? Now, assuming that the Sfat Emet knew Chumash, right, he therefore knew that, of course, singular and plural, the shift in a poetic context, right, in one place from the plural to the singular, is at least occasionally significant. Now, I don't know if the Fademis is shot, right? It's against my reading also. But I just point out that the Fademis is not a wild reader to make this assertion. You can all listen to my online share, divine fantasy of male and female, he created them, if you wish, to know what I think the meaning is of Baralito and Asalito. Okay. So I just wanted to point out Fademis, but maybe he's wrong. Now, the Drashot Rabbi Yehoshua ibn Shuriz, which I know absolutely nothing about other than it seems to be a medieval text, just for fun, says in the last line, all that matters to us is Lechem Abirim, Lechem Shemalachi Hashrech Ochlinoto, Vinivla Be'evarim. So he actually just thinks Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva agree. Right? And Rabbi Shmuel is not really arguing with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Shmuel misunderstood. Of course, Rabbi Akiva thought, right, that it meant both of them, Abirim and Evarim. Right? Because any bread that belongs to angels, of course, would never have to excrete. Okay. Now at the end of the Tzfat he says, or I should go back to Tzfat briefly, verse 7, he says, Miu, the Zohar mashma ki Rabbi Akiva. The Zohar implies Rabbi Akiva's right, Rak dehamon kishabala mata nishdame liyotolo shem lechem, umalachay sharet ochlinoto kimoshu kodem ashini liyot lechem. The Zohar seems to imply like Rabbi Akiva, right, that actually angels eat man too, just they eat it before it becomes lechem. Right, it's the same material, just before it becomes lechem. Okay, you can take that as you will. Now, are there any? Now, we started by taking the position that angels don't eat, and we saw there seems to be a halakhic implication of that in Maram, which is that we don't expect human beings to survive without food either. Are there any halakhic implications to the notions that angels eat? So, if you take a look at the Zohar, source number 9, the Zohar tells us, Tinina, Natilo Kadayim Kodim La'Achila. You have to wash your hands before you eat. Why? My Tama, begin the achila itrif nekiyuk, because eating requires cleanliness. Kegam de malachi asheret le'ela, just like the angels above. And we prove, rather than go through a whole proof where it says, what is it? Because Rav Hamnuna Saba said, what does it mean, lechem abrim achal ish? That, right, it means the bread that the angels eat. Now we ask, who cares that the angels eat bread? Obviously, the reason we learn that angels eat bread is to teach us that we should eat bread just like angels do. Now, how do angels eat bread? What, would angels eat bread without washing? That's what I didn't make this up. it's a version of the proof that Yaakov Avinu wore a shrimal. You all know, right? Because
they say Yaakov.
When Yaakov got out without a shrimal, right? That's essentially what we prove, right? Angels eat bread. Would angels eat bread without washing? No, of course not.
So why are we required to eat in the ways that angels do?
Because we're supposed to be like angels, of course.
Why is that, of course?
Because he's Kadishnam v'hisem Kedoshim. Right? Who are the Kedoshim? The Shem, of course, are the angels. So we're supposed to be like angels. And that's what he says, because I'll say, V'yitem kidoshim means that you're supposed to watch Mayim Achronim. V'yit Kaddish 10 means you're supposed to watch Mayim Rishonim. This may not have been obvious to you previously.
Ah, but Chazal were much better readers of the text than I was. So
well, I'm not taking any...
Kaddish 10 means V'yit Kaddish 10.
I'm not taking any positions about who wrote the Zohar. The author of the Zohar presents Chazal as saying that when Chazal say "vis kaddish tam v'sem kedoshim" means that you should wash your hands before and after, it does not mean that there is something holy about washing. It means that, right, I think, it means that you should be like angels, and being like angels means to wash. Okay, that's one interesting nafkamina of angel eating, is that we learn Nitilat Yadayim. But there are others. The Rav Yoh in source number 10 says that there are prushim, right, there are these people who distinguish themselves religiously, she'acharei baruchu, after Baruch Hu on the night of Yom Kippur, they stand on their feet all day and all night. Why? Because we have a text in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, Perek Mem Vav. In our edition, it's not Perek Mem Vav, but okay. Ra'a Samael, right? Samael saw Shelo Matza Chet Bisrael Yom Kippurim, that he found no sin in the Jews Yom Kippur. So Amar Lishnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu, and he said before God, Ribono Olamim, Master of the Universe, Yesh Lecha Am Echad Ba'aret K'Malachei Hasharei. You have one nation in the land that are like the ministering angels. Ma malachei hasharei yichay pei regel af Yisrael can be Yom Kippurim. Just like the angels are barefoot, so too the Jews are barefoot. Ma malachei hasharei ein lan kfatim. Just like angels don't have knees, kach Yisrael amdim la raglam Yom Kippurim. So too the Jews stand upright the entire Yom Kippur and act as if they have no knees. Well, if you're going to fall into bed, just make sure you're just sort of going without bending your knees. So the key point is not standing. The key point is not bending your knees. Why it makes one holy to not have knees is beyond me. But again, these are not texts that I'm very.
Does that mean
Any Tanakhic basis that we don't have need?
No.
Yeah. Reglehem, regle yashara. Angels have a straight leg. What does it mean? What, to not having need? Yeah. You're supposed to, right? There are people who have the custom of standing all day so that they won't be like angels who don't have need.
Maybe it's probably because the
Ilin
tradition, they're always wakeful. It's connected.
That would be. I know, is that what it says? It says Ilin Kfasim. I don't know, okay? Mamal Chashir is in Ochlim Veshotim, and just like angels don't eat, so too the Jews don't eat. Right, and just as Malach Hesher Nikiim, Askan Yisrael Nikiim Mikol Chayv Yom Kippurim, the Malach Hesher Shalom Benihem, Kach Yisrael Yom Kippurim. Now this is sort of peculiar. So we learn some things from the physicality of angels, but on the other hand, it says here that angels don't eat. Now the question is, when don't angels eat? Ever? Or just on Yom Kippur? I don't know. Probably ever.
Because they never have
knees. Okay. They never have knees.
Fine. They're never wearing shoes.
Okay, so now we have an interesting nafkamina of maybe the reason we fast on Yom Kippur is to be like angels who don't eat. That's right, although we have another nafkamina of behavior like angels, which is that we stand to be like angels, and we ordinarily wash our hands during the year to eat like angels. So if you put these two texts together, it means we fast on Yom Kippur the way the angels do. But okay. I agree, it's problematic.
Hold on, but there's no way. It doesn't add the Yom Kippurim in the second line. Does that mean that it's...
That's true. It may just be a full time. I agree.
No, meaning it might be on Yom Kippur, just like obviously Ak Yisrael can imply on Yom Kippur, but it doesn't mean to add that because the angels are also only on Yom Kippur, don't
you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Rush, however, makes it explicit, right? He says, just like the angels don't eat on Yom Kippur, don't eat, so too the Jews are that way on Yom Kippur. Kippur, right, as we're ready to point out correctly, that the line B'yom HaKippurim is missing at the end of that. Okay. I don't know. If we learn three things, we learn that just like the angels have peace among them, we should have peace among ourselves. But these two texts seem to think that while there are many other things we learn from angels, washing before eating can't be one of them, probably because angels don't eat. Okay. So right now it's really just, we have a Gemara, which we're not sure what it means. So the Sfat Emet kind of confused us. But then we discovered Rabbi Yeshua ibn Shu'iv also seems to think that everybody agrees that angels eat, because at least he combines Rabbi Akiva Shmuel's position. The Zohar clearly believes that angels eat. But Rabbi Yonah Rashi, however, quotes the text, even though they think that angels are physical, right, and that angels, but they don't think that angels eat. Now, the Yehuda Ya'aleh, the Maria Sad, does something that probably makes us very happy. He says, what he says is, "V'zeh l'shon sefer hon asir yoma," which is a Kabbalistic sefer of which I am unaware. I don't know anything about it. "Matkil b'shin m'tzayim b'lamid." So there is a word which begins with the shin and ends with the lamid, which may or may not be the following word. This is a reference to "Harei shal na'alcha me'al raglecha." It's a reference to when Moshe by the burning bush is told, remove your shoes from your feet. The Yom Kippurim be asur b'ni lat sandal. On Yom Kippur, you can't wear shoes. So Moshe then was like being on Yom Kippur. Why? The zero meiz lishlilut kolkot haguf k'mosh kasuv chazal. The zavar tshichal Yom Kippurim k'day lidamot l'machei hasharet. Okay, so being barefoot is symbolism to completely removing yourself from the body. Right? Just like angels are completely removed from the body, so too we should. How can angels be barefoot? What do you mean? Why would angels wear shoes? Right. Doesn't make any sense. So he says, "Avalo kivanahu, kemosh anahu malbush al haregel." Just like the shoe is dressed for the foot, "Kein haguf hakomer hu malbush l'neshama." So the body is just the dress of the soul. "Umalachi asheret he mushatim mechomer kischalim nidalim hema." And the angels who are completely removed from matter because they are separated intellect. So too, Jews and Yom Kippur are barefoot, completely removed from the from material. So at this point, we're pretty happy again, right? Because basically we have the conflict between the Sfat Emet and Yudah Yahleh. Right? Sfat Emet says that everybody agrees that angels eat, and that really seems to be taken fairly literally. They eat something like bread, it's bread that is somewhat different above than below. On the other hand, Yudah Yahleh says, no, nobody thinks that any of this physical stuff about angels is true. And so when it says that even when angels wear shoes, right, all it just means is that angels represent the capacity to, right, that we are symbolizing our desire to be like angels, which means, right, as per Midrash, that we are symbolizing our capacity to overcome our bodies. Okay, so we can go back to thinking it's a machloket Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva has some kind of notion that angels eat, but the mainstream tradition is that angels don't eat. Sfat Emet, despite having a really interesting reading of Tehillim and a really interesting reading of the Gemara, the Sfat Emet is some kind of marginal 19th century Hasidic figure, and we can go back happily to our position. Now, it might just be noted that if you ask ideologically which of the positions of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel are more congenial to contemporary sensibilities, whether our goal is to overcome the body or our goal is to sanctify the body, so it turns out actually Rabbi Akiva comports more with most contemporary sensibilities, which assume that the body is capable of holiness. Right? It doesn't just have to be overcome. But that would make us all pretty happy. Except we probably should ask the question, well, so is the Sfat Emet a wild, hypersensitive, Kabbalistically imposed reading on a straightforward text? Or is Rabbi Assad late apologetic, based on the position that does not believe that angels can possibly eat, which is no longer sufficiently Aristotelian to believe that things that exist need to be sustained because, right, we are now Platonists, so we think that ideas can exist. So we're perfectly happy saying that there are angels, and angels are some kind of flowery metaphor. They're ideas, and ideas don't have to be supported, right? Because we think that ideas really exist. But if you're an Aristotelian, so you think ideas only exist insofar as they are instantiated, and therefore, if the idea of angels exists, there has to be an angel. And if it's an angel, then it has to exist. And if it exists, then it has to be fixed. Okay.
I guess I'm still getting cut off on this thing. Yeah. I don't think the idea that something needs to
There is an amount of a great matter. Ramzu Rabbi Peter Masechet Yoma, he quotes our dialogue between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel. V'inyan hazeh shamar Rabbi Akiva hu, shekiyum malachei hasharet beziv hashchina. What Rabbi Akiva means is not that the angels eat bread. What it means is that the angels are sustained by the radiance of the divine presence. But like the Zohar, the radiance of the divine presence, when it descends into the lower world, becomes the mana. Okay, so angels do something which on their level is analogous to what eating is, and the machlokas Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva turns out to be entirely about, right, Rabbi Akiva believes that the man didn't really change when it came down, and so the Jews reached the level where they could eat the Ziv HaShchina the same way the angels did. And Rabbi Shmuel believes that no, right? It must have, right? It must be that the man is in a form which is different than the, when it, the Jews ate it, which is different than the form in which the angels ate it. Okay, now this is sort of a halfway congenial house. But we should note the Rambam 14, which I have not translated. Rambam 14 quotes Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, right? And he tells us that the Sa'ir la'Azazel is the is the lechem of the Se'irim, meaning the angels of the forces of darkness. Right, which also which God commands us to feed on Yom Kippur. So what I would tell him is this, I would say as follows. The framework of the discussion of whether angels eat or not in Jewish tradition is not a framework, right? It's not a Platonic framework. It's an Aristotelian framework. It's an Aristotelian framework, it's not a Platonic framework. The standard vision of Jewish, the standard reading of the Gemara Numa in the tradition is everybody assumes that angels engage in some kind of eating, although there seems to have been a counter tradition which says angels don't eat, but it might be to get out of that by just claiming angels don't eat. What they do is they feed off of the Hashkinah. The question then is, so we have a really appealing drush, which the Yudah Yaled develops, which I just take into a different direction, which says that let's ignore the physics and the assumptions behind it. Let's just say, what's really going on here is a discussion about how we ought to relate to our bodies, and then we have no difficulty dealing with it. But for the Rishonim, and probably for Chazal, the notion that we were talking purely about abstraction as opposed to a real question about whether angels eat, would have been alien to them, right? That's not fair to what they're doing. They're having a discussion about real being, right? This is why we laugh at the notion of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. Right? How many angels can dance on the head of a pin is a very serious question. The question is not whether it's 16 or 24. The question is whether angels occupy any space and there's impingement from the metaphysical world and the physical world, so that you can ask that question because angels occupy a finite amount of space and therefore there has to be a finite number of angels who can dance on the head of a pin, or whether angels are not in space, and so the whole question is ridiculous. And that's the issue. So I think that the world of the tradition is largely a world which assumes that metaphysical beings have real existence, which is parallel to physical existence, and that might actually parallel into interesting hakira we have is something of a coincidence. So the question that I would leave is, as we read the Yom Kippur liturgy, the question is, in what way, on the one hand, to make this meaningful to ourselves, I don't think any of us wants to go back to a pure Aristotelian perspective right now, but what is the intellectually honest way of using these sources, understanding where they came from in their own terms, and nonetheless, making them meaningful to ourselves, and doing that without distorting them, so that we're actually worshiping ourselves. Because if it turns out that Pshat and Rabbi Yishmael is that angels do eat, they just don't eat the same thing or the Tiva thinks they eat, and we use Rabbi Yishmael because we want there to be a position that angels don't eat. So we use Rabbi Yishmael to generate the position that angels don't eat so that we can generate the position that we want to transcend the body, right? We're not being true to him in any sense whatsoever. So that would leave in Morin's Dr. Hammer, right? So much of his, right, when he talked about religion and conversations they have with children as well. Right, these are the kind of issues that really, really interested him. Right, is how you take a text, you approach it with complete intellectual honesty, and you still find a way to make it meaningful, compelling, and honestly interpreted. In our day, hope that enhances your Yom Kippur as well. And I thank you very much for listening. I should say that if you like this share, you should please go to www.torahleadership.org and study the shiurim there. You should please consider applying to the Center for Torah Leadership Summer Beit Midrash program, which Ben has been through and can tell you about as well. And if you're willing to sign up, so you can be notified about such things, I'll have a piece of paper signing up, or you can take brochures about the center as a whole and look up the. This is only one brochure about the summer program right now, but you can do that online as well. And thank you very much.